Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Friday, September the 21st. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. And it's time for our Friday Week in Review, when we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the top political news stories of the week. And we are happy to have with us today Tony Palmieri, Associate Professor of Communications, a former Green Party candidate for state legislature, and a member of the Oshkosh Common Council. He's also a media columnist for the Fox Valley's alternative newspaper, The Valley Scene. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And also in studio, John Sharpless, Professor of History at UW-Madison and a former Republican candidate for Congress. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's also invite listeners to join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, looking for the news story that happened this week that's of most interest to you or that you would like our two guests to talk about. So something from the news this week. Senate Democrats say they don't have the votes, but that's not keeping them from introducing one bill after another opposing the Iraq war. In the news this morning, the Democrats plan to try again today with another anti-war proposal by Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. Levin's bill would order combat troops home in 9 months. It's expected to fail, as did a proposal yesterday from Russ Feingold that would have cut off funding for combat as of next June. Let's listen to Russ Feingold from the Senate floor yesterday.
Training should be training, not a ruse for keeping American troops on the front lines of the Iraqi Civil War. Such turbulence cannot and will not be resolved by a massive military engagement. The administration's surge is another dead end.
So, Professor Sharpless, what's your take on Congress's action this week to still try to get some sort of withdrawal or withdrawal of funding and end the surge?
Well, obviously a lot of particularly left Democrats feel very strongly about stopping the war. And I think this is the congressional leadership appealing to that constituency. I'm not sure the general public's following this anymore. I think the big battle 6 months ago that failed had a public audience. Now that's bill after bill, different kinds of deadlines, different kinds of restrictions. I don't think the public follows these bills. I don't think the debates are followed very closely by most people. And to the extent that this discussion of the war is public, I think it's moved out of Congress. I think it's moved to the candidates for the presidency. Yeah. So I'm not sure where the Democrats in Congress are going on this. They can certainly keep doing it. The votes aren't there. And quite clearly, after the last 2 weeks, it's clear that the president is going to stand pat on this to the end of his administration. And that's it. It's a deadlock.
Yeah, Tony Palmieri.
Oh, I disagree with John strongly on this. I think the public is following this very closely. Ed Garvey at his Fighting Bob Fest gets, it seems like, 1,000 more people every year. Largely, it's the war protest that is drawing people there, and those are not just fringe left Democrats. Those are people from all over the state. I hear students talking about it on campus more than ever before. People are upset at the length of this war. They're upset that the mission is not clear, and all they see us doing is dying and killing for what is not a clearly identified purpose. But, you know, Joy, one of the real scandals in the United States Senate is that all of these measures that you're talking about have had a majority of votes, but now it takes 60 votes to do anything in the U.S. Senate. And that's a real scandal, and I think that's political cowardice in Washington. If they've got 55 votes to set a withdrawal date, 55 votes ought to do it. They ought not need 60 votes to do it.
Yeah. Let's also listen to Senator Jim Webb, who had a proposal that was defeated, I think, on Wednesday of this week in the Senate that would have required troops in Iraq to spend 12 months at home before spending more time in Iraq.
We've listened. This amendment is an adjustment from the amendment that was offered last July. We have spoken with Secretary Gates. We've modified the language of it. It is needed. It's needed in a way that's beyond politics and certainly would not contribute to what some people are calling defeat.
And Secretary of Defense Gates said that the Webb proposal was a backdoor way of getting troop withdrawals. John Sharpless?
Oh, yeah, certainly it is. But more important, I actually watched that debate. I don't know what that's saying about this stage of my life if I'm watching C-SPAN. but McCain had a very powerful rebuttal, and he read from federal law that's accumulated since the 1950s. And this really is an attempt on the part of Congress to intercede itself on the decision-making powers of the Commander-in-Chief. And it flies directly into a host of constitutional decisions and the text of federal law. And I think Jim Webb knows that. I actually have considerable respect for Jim Webb, and I was very impressed that he changed parties and came out against the war as strongly as he did, and he's a deeply committed man. But I disagree with him on this, not only in terms of its tactic, but in terms of the statute law, which it violates.
Mm-hmm. Tony Palmieri.
Well, I think what Senator Webb realizes is that the National Guard and Reserves have been abused in this war in a way that we've not seen previously. And what he was asking for was a very simple measure that would say you spend equal amount of time at home as you do in the theater, so to speak. And, you know, I thought many of the Democrats made a good point. With the Republicans' vote on that, they really made it their war. It's not really George Bush's war now. It is the Republicans' war. And quite frankly, just as I think they paid for it at the polls in 2006, I think they're going to pay for it again in 2008. I honestly disagree with Professor Sharpless here. I think the public in 08 is going to speak loud and clear once again that they want to see an end to this conflict.
Mm-hmm. The one thing the Senate did pass yesterday, I don't have the exact vote in front of me, but it was a resolution condemning an advertisement by the group MoveOn.org. Many of us saw this in the New York Times late last week. It called General David Petraeus, General Betrayus, and the Senate condemned that ad. And I think 22 Democrats voted in favor of that condemnation. What do you think of that, Tony Palmieri?
Well, more political cowardice in the Senate. But, you know, think about it, Joy. If you're a peace group or an anti-war group and you want to get involved in the national debate and you're competing with Britney Spears, O.J. Simpson, Michael Vick, how do you get on the cable networks? I mean, we've reached the point where you have to say or do something shocking. I mean, I'm sure the folks at MoveOn would rather have put in an ad that said, "We respectfully disagree with General Petraeus and President Bush." But everyone knows that would not have made the national media. So until our national press makes it clear that they're going to treat the war seriously, we're going to see more shock rhetoric, as I'll call it. So it's unfortunate. And then, of course, the United States Senate does this cowardly thing of, condemning an ad.
John Sharpless?
Well, I agree with everything but the statement about Congress. The Senate can pass any kind of resolutions it wants to. It has a long history of doing so. And I'm not sure it shows any kind of cowardice at all. It just shows how they feel about the ad. And I found the ad a bit offensive, but we live in a society in which ads like that can be published. I love that society. I love that kind of exchange. And I will agree with you that we're in a tough news period where soft news, celebrity news, does dominate. And I think the more serious political news, whether it's this or other things, tends to get pushed back. It's the quick comment at the end of the hour, at the beginning of the hour, as we move on to Britney Spears. And I could see an organization like Move On deciding to be provocative in order to get into the discourse. And that's unfortunate. Obviously, cable networks, if you just watch them over an afternoon, and again, my life is really sluggish, so I'll sit and watch these. You look at the bulk of what they do over an afternoon, and it's really quite silly stuff. And I agree. I think that for an organization like Move On, if they want to be in the discourse, if they want to be a source of discussion, they're provocative.
Let me get a caller in on this. Dave in Wanakee. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think it's been a busy week for Republicans. Bush vetoed the health care to children without insurance. The Senate Republicans filibustered a bill that would have required soldiers to have as much home time as time spent in combat zones, but what they focused on was a bill attacking MoveOn.org for the General Petraeus ad. I think that this is just an attempt to distract from the fact that our military is stuck in a quagmire in Iraq. Osama bin Laden is loose and making threats, and Republicans believe the U.S. policy should be permanent military presence with Iraq as our client state.
Yeah, we'll be talking about a lot of those other issues you brought up. Do you think, John Sharpless, this is just a distraction, the GOP voting or the Senate voting on this?
I don't know how much time they spent on it. My guess is the Senate's constantly distracted. It's hardly an institution. It's hardly an institution I'm going to defend it at any length. I personally think it's been a bad year for Republicans. I don't know if this is a bad week for Republicans and a bad year for Republicans. I think the Republican Party was given a great trust. I've been very critical of them on this show. After 9/11, the nation looked to a Republican president and a Republican House and Senate and gave them a great trust. They actually increased the numbers in that first off-year election. And I don't think that Republicans have lived up to that trust. Not simply, and I've supported the war, and frankly, I support the recent surge, and I was very impressed with the report. I may be a minority on that now. But I think they also failed in terms of our national budget, and they promised Social Security reform, and they didn't do it. There's a host of things that the Republican Party failed on.
Mm-hmm. Tony Palmieri.
Well, I agree with much of what the caller Dave said. I mean, with all due respect to General Petraeus, I thought his testimony before the Congress was lame. And so the Republicans would rather talk about a MoveOn.org ad than talk about the actual testimony or the actual condition on the ground. I mean, here's General Petraeus saying the security situation is getting better. And yet, just last week, we had a Sunni leader who meets with George Bush. I think it was on a Monday, and by Thursday, that same man is assassinated. How can the general look at the American public with a straight face and say the security situation has improved? I mean, you have to be deep inside the green zone to be secure in Iraq. Everywhere else, it seems to be open season. So I think Dave is right about distraction going on.
We'll talk more about the news of the week after this short pause. Our guests, Tony Palmieri and John Sharpless, we have an open line for you if you'd like to call in with an item from the news this week that you would like us to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. This is the Friday Week in Review, where we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week during this 8 o'clock hour, and every afternoon on Fridays at 4 o'clock, it's your views on the news. Jean Purcell will be in for Ben Marins today with a guest talking with you on the week's most significant news stories. That's after 4 this afternoon. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you would like to join in this Friday Week in Review, our guest Tony Palmieri and John Sharpless. A couple of other points on this MoveOn.org ad and the vote in the Senate yesterday to condemn the ad. We have Hillary Clinton leading a Democratic presidential candidate and another presidential candidate, Christopher Dodd, voting against the resolution. It passed 72-25. Senator Barack Obama ended up not voting at all, I believe. He was absent for the vote. Comments on the how this is going to play in the presidential race, Tony Palmieri?
Well, it would be nice for the candidates to step forward and say, you know, generals are not immune from criticism. That's what was disturbing about the Senate resolution to me. If you read it, they are essentially saying, hands off General Petraeus. He should be immune from criticism. And that, to me, seems absurd. I mean, imagine if it was 1967 and we're talking about General Westmoreland. I mean, should Westmoreland not have been receiving criticism in Vietnam? So I'm glad to see that Clinton and Dodd voted against it. Hopefully they'll lead a national dialogue about the need to have a thriving First Amendment in which we get to make criticisms of all people in public life, and no one is immune from it.
Mm. John Sharpless?
Well, I think a criticism of his report or his position or what he said before the Senate is appropriate. Calling him names is not. And that's really the thrust of this. I suspect if there had been an ad that called him to task without using the phrase betray us, this Senate resolution would not have been brought forward.
Because no one would be talking about it.
Now, wait a minute. The important thing here is that the critique was not aimed at the critique. It was aimed at the inappropriate language that surrounded that critique. They may have chosen it to get in the news. That's fine. But then they have to weather the fallout for having used a personal attack when I think what was appropriate was a critique of his policies or the report or his presentation in Congress. I was struck the other day, again, I'm watching way too much C-SPAN. After George Bush's speech, C-SPAN has a call-in thing where you can call in on the Democrat line, the independent Republican line. The first Democrat caller called in, and their comment on Bush's speech was that he was retarded. Mm. And I was struck with that. That's not a critique of the speech. That's just, I don't like George Bush, and I'm going to, you're ugly. And a caution to Democrats, if you continue with that, you're going to lose them next year. The American people are not interested in that. They're not interested in you calling George Bush stupid or calling the general a betrayer. They're certainly interested in the critique of the war. They may well rally to you as the party of evacuation. But if they continue to make this an ad hominem attack on George Bush and people who speak for the war, they're going to lose.
Yeah. Tony?
I'm not a big fan of ad hominem attacks, but actually if you look at the MoveOn.org ad, it had several paragraphs identifying times when General Petraeus had exaggerated, misled, and so on and so forth. And so to conclude that that would constitute betrayal, I don't call that a personal attack. If MoveOn feels it can document times when the general in charge of forces has been misleading or has exaggerated, or who does seem to be supporting the president more than what is good for the public at large, then I think betrayal becomes a reasonable label for that. I don't see that as a mere personal attack. That is not equivalent to me to someone calling the president retarded and not backing it up.
Let's move on to some other issues. Lots of stuff in the news this morning. American convoys under the protection of Blackwater USA resumed today, 4 days after the U.S. Embassy suspended all land travel by its diplomats and other civilian officials in response to the alleged killing of civilians by the security firm Blackwater. John Sharpless, comments on that?
I just had a student, this is a great paper. It did go on a lot. It was about, when he was done, it was his senior paper, about 100 pages, on the privatization of American military worldwide. And this has been happening over about 4 decades. And I think the Blackwater incident has exposed this. And this is where I'm going to critique the press. I really think there's been insufficient coverage of this trend toward privatization. It's not the first time in history, obviously, that there's been the use of non-national personnel in wars in the 17th, 18th, and to some extent in the 19th century. European powers used mercenaries to a great extent. In our own revolution, the British were using the Hussians, for example. But the problem with these paramilitary groups is there's no accountability, none at all. There's no accountability at two levels, whether or not they're providing us the services they're supposed to, because they're often hired at arm's length to do whatever they're supposed to do. Sometimes it's security. Sometimes it's relatively innocuous things like transporting and building. But second of all, there's no accountability for incidents, conflicts with civilians and the enemy.
Yeah.
And so I really think this is a really important matter. And maybe this Blackwater incident, this is where Congress should be shining a bright light. And we should be asking whether or not we should be hiring soldiers to fight in the name of the United States when they are not tied to the United States in direct ways.
I'm guessing, Tony, you might agree with
that. Yeah, I think John is absolutely correct. And, you know, some of the left publications like The Nation have been talking about this for years, but the national press, unfortunately, has not picked it up. And so hopefully the Congress will have extensive investigations of this. And, you know, my concern is that what ultimately this will all lead to is a revival of talk about having a draft.
Well, let me bring in a couple of callers who want to talk about Blackwater. Lucille in Algoma. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, they've pretty much discussed what I was going to question. I can't believe that our country is spending all this money on these private security companies and not doing anything about changing it. I think it's terrible.
Yeah, thank you, Lucille. Let me see what Gordon in St. Cloud wants to say about this. Hi, Gordon.
Good morning to you. I'm glad to hear your guests talk about Blackwater for a change. And I wonder, the numbers of participants in Blackwater in Iraq, I have heard, are equal to the number of military people that we have there. I understand the Constitution, although I don't agree, on a right to bear arms. But where in the Constitution is there a right to develop a private army?
Yeah. I talked to a guest from, you know, a former military guy, a diplomat, now a political scientist and analyst, who says the military can't stand that Blackwater is doing what it's doing in Iraq and doesn't like this private contracting of this kind of duty. But in a bind, he says, because there aren't enough people in the Army, not enough troops to do all of this, that, you know, so it's sort of they don't want them there, but they have to have them there. And Tony Palmieri, that's what you were hinting at.
Well, hopefully those military leaders will step forward and lead the call for investigation of it and for reform. I think the callers, Gordon and Lucille, are correct. There's nothing in the United States Constitution that calls for a private mercenary force. But on the other hand, there's nothing in the literal reading of the U.S. Constitution that calls for wars that have not been declared by Congress. So, you know, you could make the argument, as I would, that this entire endeavor is unconstitutional, and the Blackwater fiasco adds one more component to that. Gordon, I think, said that the Blackwater numbers are as high as the U.S. military. John may know the numbers. I believe there are 180,000 total private contractors there, but they're not all Blackwater. I'm not sure of the number of Blackwater.
Yeah. Do you know?
My student estimated about 200,000 private contractors,
okay.
But that includes people doing food service and transportation and logistics. And one of the things that's a bit distressing about companies like Blackwater is that they, because they're a corporation, they're under no obligation to tell us anything about their funding. They're not under any obligation to tell us their numbers. They're not under any obligation to tell us about their recruitment and training policies. They feel, and I can certainly understand this. I mean, they're a corporation that wants to make money. They feel very, very private and protective about this information. They're very hesitant to make any kind of public statements. I don't know if you've noticed since the incident, they've been extraordinarily silent. And incidents that have occurred over the past 3 years, what often happens is that they will very quietly take the men who were involved in the troublesome engagement. They'll bring them back home, and they'll handle it all themselves. There's another thing that happens here. I don't want to turn the young men who work for Blackwater into, you know, victims. They're doing it to make money. Many of them are ex-American soldiers, and you know, many of them are very credible young men who think they're performing a service. One of the sad things that happens here is that there's a number of incidents where they die and their families are never told.
Yeah.
Because Blackwater has no obligation, as does the United States government, to offer any public statement about the loss of personnel in combat areas. One final thing. Iraq is not the only place that we're using mercenaries. They're in Somalia right now. They're in Chad, scattered throughout Africa. I believe Indonesia. So We have, over the past, and it's been happening for a much longer time than I think Americans realize, we've been supplementing our military and diplomatic efforts abroad with a private contingent.
Yeah. We have lots of callers on this, but we only have time maybe for one more comment. Joe in Verona. Hi, Joe.
Hey, good morning. I'm a former military member, and the idea that we're hiring Blackwater and the other Merck organizations to supplement our manpower is flat out bogus, frankly. If we wanted to hire more people in the military, it's a real easy way. We pay them more. And that would be simple because we're paying Blackwater and other Mercks 3 to 6 times what a military personnel of the same capability and rank would be doing. So the only reason we're hiring these guys is to go off the reservation and to have no accountability, no oversight, and no allegiance to anybody except themselves. I'm really, really disturbed and scared by this kind of activity.
Yeah. Well, no disagreement from either of our guests, I think. Anything further, John Sharpless or Tony Palmieri, on that?
All I can say is I really hope that there's investigations, and if we decide in the course of a debate in Congress and a national debate on this, we want mercenaries. That's fine. There certainly is a tradition in the history in military history of using mercenaries. But I think what's happened here is this is one of those things that has very quietly grown to a major commitment in terms of resources without a lot of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And I want to see it investigated.
Well, let's move on to some other issues. I don't know, Tony Palmieri, if you saw a coverage of this particular issue in your news because it was in the Madison Market, but let's take a chance. Students who were protesting Halliburton's presence at a UW-Madison career fair yesterday afternoon, sat in front of the company's booth. They were singing anti-war songs and getting in the way of the company's attempts to recruit students from the UW-Madison campus. The organizers of this protest were trying to tie a connection between how students protested Dow Chemical recruiters back in the Vietnam War, and they thought that Halliburton should not be on campus, should not be recruiting students, and Halliburton was profiting off the war and shouldn't be there. Did you catch any of that, John Sharpless?
I did. Mm-hmm. I was struck that it was not of the size of the 1960s. I know they view themselves in that tradition. I don't think, and this goes back to our earlier discussion, I don't think they have much support across the students. Even among students who dissent on the war, this current group of students see this kind of confrontational protest. I guess they would use the word lame. They just view it as inappropriate, not very effective, a bit on the silly side. They certainly have every right to protest as long as they don't physically, and this is where I think the line should be drawn. I don't think they should physically keep students from talking to a Halliburton recruiter, and I don't think they should physically assault a Halliburton recruiter.
Did they do that?
No, they didn't.
No, okay.
And I'm just saying that's the limit. But if they want to march around with placards, that's the Wisconsin tradition, and let them do it.
Yeah, the protest organizer estimated the crowd at about 200 people. Media reports I saw, you guys get in trouble with numbers, said it was more like 100 people. But Tony Palmieri, are you familiar with this story?
Somewhat. Well, I'll tell you, even if it were only 20 or 30 people protesting at a job fair, I think that's significant. Uh-huh. And the idea that there are young people that are concerned about war profiteering, that are concerned about no-bid government contracts, that are concerned about the Vice President of the United States having these kinds of insider connections with a corporation. I mean, I think that's good. And I think that, yeah, there are lots of students that are uncomfortable with that kind of protest, but I'll tell you, they are watching and they are listening. And you know, maybe they are learning something, and maybe this group will succeed in getting not just young people, but all age groups to tap into their conscience and ask, why do we allow big corporations like this to get these privileges in Iraq and other places? So I applaud those student leaders, and I hope they continue.
Yeah. Quickly, before we move on to some other national and state issues, What do you think of Osama bin Laden? Yet another audio tape yesterday, this time calling on Pakistanis to revolt against their president. John Sharpless?
You know, I don't know what to do with this. I guess I'm part of the skeptical bunch. I still don't know if this guy's really alive. I maybe he is. Maybe he's turning out these tapes. It is interesting that he's turning on the leadership in Pakistan in such an aggressive way. He has been, I think, if he does exist, and he is where we say broadly he is, in that area on the northern border of Pakistan, as it sort of fades into the mountains of Afghanistan, I don't know how much he can push and not find himself a subject of direct confrontation. And so I think it's an interesting move. It's a very interesting move. And it's clearly timed with the return to Pakistan of two national leaders that have been in exile and the upcoming elections.
Tony Palmieri?
Yeah, I think the idea that international terrorism is being directed and led by some guy making videos out of a cave, I mean, this is kind of like the fantasy of the American corporate media. I mean, the sad reality is that the best recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda in the last 6 years has been George W. Bush, and that is sad. It's almost like bin Laden, if he is alive, is struggling for relevancy. And it's, I don't think Osama bin Laden has credibility with the overwhelming majority of people who feel they have oppression and so on and so forth. So, you know, but it does also show that the Bush administration has been completely misguided in the last 6 years. The fact that bin Laden still does have a kind of pull is, kind of incredible.
Yeah. One more international issue before we move on to things closer to home. The deputy commander of Iran's Air Force says plans have been drawn up to bomb Israel if Israel attacks his country. So things are heating up in that region, John Sharpless.
I don't even know what to say about this. I don't even know where to go on this. Clearly, the people who run around right now are a strange bunch, but they do love to play the media. Their national leader wanted to go to ground zero. They roughly at the same time, you have the commander of their armed forces tell the public that they've come up with war plans involving Israel. The notion that Israel would invade Iran is just loopy. I mean, they're not even adjacent. And there's been no aggressive behavior on the part of Israel in any way whatsoever toward Iran. So it's a very strange thing to say publicly. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, what do you make of it, Tony Palmieri?
It's sad, and it shows a failure of leadership, I think, from third parties like the United States, like the European Union, that should be in there trying to facilitate dialogue between countries. And instead, especially the Bush administration, I think, has made the situation more tense by refusing any kind of meaningful dialogue with Iran. And I think when that's the reality, when the most powerful country in the world is a force to discourage dialogue rather than open it up, you're going to see more saber rattling.
Mm-hmm. How do you have dialogue with these turkeys? I mean, I don't understand why the United States, I don't care if it was George Bush or if Hillary Clinton was our president, it doesn't really, why should they engage in dialogue with people who talk this way? Why should they engage in dialogue with a national leader in that country that held a conference to which he invited all the people in the world who were deniers of the Holocaust? This guy's a clown. And if he was in any other setting, no one would pay any attention to him, but sadly, he runs a very powerful nation in his region. He has the potential for atomic technology. Dialogue's wonderful. I love it. I'm a college professor. But there's nothing golden about dialogue. Yeah. And I don't see any point in talking to these guys.
We're going to have to dialogue some more after this short break. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will be on tape today, and they will be talking about the 50 greatest mysteries of the universe. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review, talking with Tony Palmieri, an associate professor of communications at UW Oshkosh, a former Green Party candidate for state legislature and a member of the Oshkosh Common Council, and John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison, a former Republican candidate for Congress, talking with us about the major political news stories of the week from Wisconsin to the world. Talked a lot of world issues so far. There's so many interesting issues in the news, and we're running short on time. I almost don't know where to start. Let's see if John Sharpless, have any comments on Dan Rather filing a lawsuit seeking $70 million, I think, in damages against CBS, saying that CBS made him the scapegoat in that controversial story regarding President Bush's National Guard service back during the Vietnam War, and that CBS caved to pressure from the White House and you know, ousted Dan Rather over this. What do you make of that?
I think this is a fun story. Normally, I don't watch Larry King live, but last night I made a point of doing it because I wanted to see what Dan, how he explained all this. And he said it's not about the money, and when people say it's not about the money, it's about the money. We'll see if there's a settlement on this. He claims that he's doing this because he wants to defend people like himself in the media who've taken aggressive, strong stands and have had appropriate independent reporting to protect them from big corporations in collusion with big government. And so he claims he's going to press this through to the very end. This could be the trial of the century. This could be lots of fun. It would be fascinating to know how CBS responded to White House pressure. It would be fascinating to know how the White House pressured on that story. What is obviously also going to come out is whether or not the story has legs. You know, Dan claims now, which is very interesting because he actually apologized publicly on his show for the false nature of the documents. I mean, that's already a matter of record.
Now, CBS made him do that, I think. Isn't that
well,
what
that's what he
now?
Claims. Yeah. Yeah, he was made to do that. He's claiming that right at the time of the crisis, he was a good team player, and he did a lot of things he really didn't want to do. So certainly his positions are less than credible here. But really, if this comes to trial, it could be fun. It could be really fun. I just love to know the inside stuff at CBS. It would be great to bring in some of the Washington players to see if they did indeed call up the president of CBS and put the screws to him. It might be a chance to really get a handle on whether these documents were forgeries or not. I think they were rather uniformly condemned, and by the end of the controversy, people backed away from the claims that were made in that story.
Yeah.
I think it's fun stuff. I'd love to see this trial go forward. I suspect, though, you'll have it. I'm not so sure Dan really wants the whole thing aired publicly, and I'm sure CBS doesn't. So he might not get $70 million, but he'll get enough to buy another person.
Well, Tony, I bet you have comments on this, too, as with your media columnist hat on.
Yeah, it sounds like Dan Rather has come to the realization that corporate media makes corporate decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he became the scapegoat for a story that the White House didn't like. I mean, I'd like to see a trial, too, but I think that's what the trial will find, that CBS made a business decision, and that's what corporate media does. You know, if we see Dan Rather accompanying, say, someone like Bill Moyers on the activist circuit, and get into the ins and outs of what corporate media really does in this country, which I think is largely destructive and negative. If he goes that road, then I'll think he's serious about not being in this for a payout. But if it's all just about proving that Dan Rather was a scapegoat and that I don't think that goes far enough, I'd like to see that Dan Rather is really serious about exposing corporate media.
Let's talk also about the incident this week on the University of Florida Gainesville campus when John Kerry was at some public forum. A kid got up and was giving him a hard time with tough questions about why did you give up on the race with George Bush and why don't you try to impeach George Bush and other questions along those lines. And he was hauled off by campus police and eventually tased. What do you make of that, Tony?
Yeah, you know, in all seriousness, I think since 9/11, the empowerment to police to stifle communication at public events has been just enormous. Now, this young guy was being obnoxious, you know, he's being disrespectful, he's being rude, he wouldn't shut up. But the idea that that would lead to being hauled out and tased, I mean, anyone who doesn't see that as excessive, I think, needs to check, you know, into their values. So I think there does need to be more investigation into the powers that we've given police since 9/11 to stifle communication at public events. I mean, it's a First Amendment issue.
Yeah, even if he even if he was staging it, as some are alleging, that he wanted the cameras and he did it on purpose to get the attention, the tasing might have been a bit much, John Sharpless.
I think it's a bit much. I've got to be careful. I don't want to get in trouble. I think that, let me first preface this by saying I have an enormous respect for the campus police on this campus. I think they're very professional. But I think having contact with other universities, the truth is that campus police are not often well-trained. They're glorified security guards, and they have the budgets to have a serious firepower and equipment, and it goes to their head. Obviously, this is not the first time campus police have way overreacted at these kinds of incidents. We've grown up on our campus, and I think that our campus police really act with extraordinary restraint at moments like this. But we had the 60s and 70s. That was our learning curve. Other campuses haven't learned this. And I think if there's one area of law enforcement that needs some scrutiny, it's organizations like campus police, because they, in some ways, they're kind of like Blackwater. They're a little under the radar. And, you know, recruitment and training is different. And I just don't think they always act in professional ways, and this is clearly a moment when there was excessive force.
Yeah, boy, another issue I want to get both of you to comment on is in the news now, Congress is going to get involved in the so-called GINA 6 case in Louisiana. The chair of the House Judiciary Committee plans to hold hearings on what happened there. It was a decision by the prosecutor in this town to file tough criminal charges against black teenagers accused of beating up a white student. Blacks were outraged by this because three white teens who strung up hangman's nooses from a tree at the high school were only suspended, and then allegedly these black students retaliated by beating up the white students, and they were, I think, got charged with attempted murder and all sorts of things. Now, there was a big demonstration there yesterday. What do you make of what's happening in GINA, Louisiana, Tony Palmieri?
You know, let me refocus it, Joy. In reading about that, I noticed that not one Republican presidential candidate has agreed to go to a forum at Morgan State University, I believe, to talk about race and civil rights issues and so on. I mean, that would be a forum where this kind of issue could get some national exposure. And not one, my understanding is, not one Republican candidate will go to that forum. Even Newt Gingrich ended up attacking the other Republican candidates for that. So by national candidates trying to sweep these matters under the rug or only give little sound bites about them, I think that exacerbates the problem.
Mm-hmm. John Sharpless?
I can't unravel this thing. It's clearly, this is a town where race has been a structural component of their life since the Civil War. I've been struck in some of the more serious coverage of this little town. Everybody lives on one side or the other of the town. You know, there's a railroad track that separates this town. And when the school was integrated, There wasn't. It was as if the black school was closed, and when they were brought into the white school, they were never fully accepted. It wasn't their school. They were the students without a school, and there was this sort of, and that tradition has built over the years. The set of incidents that lead up to the moment where the student, and nothing justifies this, the student was hospitalized. He was terribly beaten. Nothing justifies that. But I do think that it's an extraordinarily difficult problem, and it really does speak, I think, to race in America. It's extremely difficult to unwrap these situations. I'm not sure Republicans showing up at Morgan State for a discussion is going to change that. But it's tragic. It really is. It's a very tragic. Every once in a while, America has a moment when we look at our soul. And I think race sits at the bottom of an American tragedy. It just does. Slavery. And we've never unwrapped that well. And I think Gina has one more time exposed that to Americans. It makes us all very uncomfortable, even if we don't even live in Gina.
Yeah. Let me get your opinions on, in the last couple of minutes of the program, on the stalled state budget talks. It's back to work again today for the committee, conference committee, trying to reach a compromise on the overdue state budget. Leave it at that. Tony Palmieri, do you think we're going to get a state budget anytime soon?
Probably within the next 3 or 4 weeks. We're now a national embarrassment. And I listened to Senator Erpenbach on your previous program. I don't think the Senate Democrats should drop the Healthy Wisconsin proposal until the Republicans come up with a serious counter proposal. But it's really a sad day in Wisconsin when we've got a full-time legislature that cannot get a budget in, and we are the only state in the nation to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they don't get one soon, I really do think, honestly, every member of the legislature should be booted out of office in the next election.
Only 30 seconds, John Sharpless, for your comments on the state budget.
You know how I feel about this. I think we need a 120-day rule. If you can't get a budget in 120 days, the whole outfit is dissolved and you have an election. I think this is so profoundly irresponsible. On both sides, it's a disgrace. These people, and normally I don't rant about special interests, but this is a group that's been placed in office primarily out of special interest money, and they don't care about Wisconsin.
We're going to have to leave it there, and we don't even have time to talk about O.J. Simpson. Aren't you glad?
Oh,
All right. Tony Palmieri, John Sharpless, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Leo Duran for producing this hour, and thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.